Friends, the next chapter in this book, The History and Principles of Literary Criticism, is Romantic Criticism by William Wordsworth. His critical works. William Wordsworth, from 1770 to 1850, is one of the greatest poets of England, one to whom Matthew Arnold assigns a place next only to Shakespeare and Milton. He was primarily a poet and not a critic. He has left behind him no comprehensive and systematic treatise on literary criticism. His criticism consists of Advertisement to Lyrical Ballads, 1798, Preface to Lyrical Ballads, 1800, Preface to Lyrical Ballads, 1802, with an appendix on Poetic Diction. For the 1815 edition, the poet wrote a new preface and the older one was added on as appendix. The volume also contained an essay supplementary to the preface. The 1802 preface is generally taken as the standard text, and competent critics regard it as a landmark in the history of criticism. Wordsworth's critical work also include his notes to The Throne and other poems, as well as critical remarks of great significance scattered all up and down his correspondence. The next subheading of this chapter is The Preface to the Lyrical Ballads, its genesis and history, its plan, its manifold themes, its aim and purpose, its historical significance. Then the first subheading, its genesis and history. Wordsworth's Preface to the Lyrical Ballads is a critical document of abiding significance. It underwent a number of revisions till it acquired its present form. The Lyrical Ballads was first published in 1798, and to this edition, Wordsworth merely added a short advertisement or introduction. To the second edition of the Lyrical Ballads, published in 1800, he added a more detailed preface. He began writing it in the summer of 1800 and completed it by the end of September. Coleridge claimed in 1802 that it was half a child of my own brain, since many of its ideas had originated in discussions between the two poets, and he may have even given further help by making notes on these topics. Nevertheless, it was Wordsworth who finally shaped this material, and in doing so, assimilated it to his own way of thinking. With several of his formulations, Coleridge subsequently came to disagree. The 1800 preface was revised, enlarged, and perfected for the 1802 edition of the Lyrical Ballads. The most significant addition to the 1802 preface is the long account of the nature, qualifications, and functions of a poet, the demonstration of his superiority over the men of science, and an examination of nature of poetic pleasure. To this edition, Wordsworth also added an appendix on poetic diction, devoted to a consideration of poetic diction and its history. The preface was constantly revised and perfected for each subsequent edition of the Lyrical Ballads, but basically the poet's views remained the same. No significant changes were made for the edition of 1805, but in the edition of 1815, this preface appeared as an appendix, and the volume was provided with an entirely new preface. To this volume, Wordsworth also added an essay supplementary to the preface. The preface that we study today is that of 1808, and as Garrod points out, The essay supplementary 1815 forms a worthy companion to it. The preface 1802, appendix on poetic diction 1802, and the essay supplementary contain all that is worthwhile in Wordsworth's literary criticism. Wordsworth's aim. Wordsworth himself tells us that his aim in writing the preface was not to give an elaborate account of his theory of poetry or to make a systematic defense of his point of view. He added the preface because he felt that his poems were of a new kind, both in theme and style, and therefore he should not hurl them at the head of the people without a word of introduction. Every new and original poet has to create the taste by which he is read and enjoyed, and the creation of such a taste was Wordsworth's basic objective in writing the preface. He seeks to bring about drastic revaluations of earlier poetry so that his own poetry may be properly appreciated. The next subheading is the dominant theme, poetic diction. The theme which dominates the preface and which Wordsworth pursues most consistently is his argument against poetic diction. As Derek Roper points out, the immediate objects of his attack were the gaudiness and inane phraseology of contemporary poets. More generally, Wordsworth is arguing against what F.W. Bateson calls a positive theory of poetic diction. Current throughout the 18th century, the belief not only that some modes of diction were best avoided in poetry, but that other modes were especially suitable. Wordsworth's fundamental objection to what he elsewhere calls a vague, glossy, and unfeeling language is that to separate poetry from ordinary speech is to separate it from human life. For him, the great value of poetry is that it permits the sharing of experience, the communication of truths carried alive into the heart by passion. The view of poetry as communication is not confined to one period or movement, but it has never been so forcefully expressed as in the great passage Wordsworth added in 1802, foreshadowed by his earlier sentence. Poetry sheds no tears, such as angels weep, but natural and human tears. She can boast of no celestial ichor, that is fluid, that distinguishes her vital juices from those of prose. The same human blood circulates through the veins of them both. The next subheading of this chapter is Plea for Simplicity in Theme and Treatment. Of equal interest and significance is Wordsworth's view of the nature and function of poetry and the process of poetic creation. Wordsworth's view of the scope of poetry is even less restricted than his view of its language. It is the honorable characteristic of poetry. He writes in 1798 that its materials are to be found in every subject which can interest the human mind, and this attitude underlines the whole preface. Several passages of 1800 can be seen as amplifications of the same idea. Subjects, no more than words, are poetic or unpoetic in themselves. A slight incident of village life may be material not merely for words of the pastoral or burlesque kind, but for serious poetry, if the poet can make it meaningful. To some extent, this view was already implicit in the work of poets as different as Burns and Cowper. But until 1798, it had not been decisively stated. In this way, does Wordsworth seek to extend the scope of poetry by bringing within its folds themes chosen from humble and common life? The preface is thus seen to be a forceful plea for simplicity both in theme and treatment. The other subheading is function of poetry, poetic pleasure. Poetry is communication, and it is his own pleasure that the poet communicates. Traditionally, the function of poetry was supposed to be both to instruct and delight, but for Wordsworth, the function of poetry is to give pleasure. However, his conception of pleasure is an exalted one. Poetic pleasure is not mere idle amusement like rope dancing or sherry drinking. Serious poetry provides a pleasure of a more exalted kind. It is the pleasure which results from increased knowledge and understanding. He considers poetry superior to both history and philosophy, as well as to science. He regards it as the most philosophical of all writings. The impassioned expression, that is, the countenance of all science. The appeal of science is merely to the intellect. Poetry complements science by adding feeling to its truth, and by its imaginative treatment, it makes people more fully aware of them. The next subheading is the poet, his qualification. In a long passage added in 1802, he gives us his views of nature and character of a poet. The poet is essentially a man speaking to man. He differs from the other man not in nature, but merely in the degree of his gifts. He is a man of greater sensibility, observation, reflection, and imagination, and of greater powers of communication. He can therefore comprehend truths to which others remain blind. He can see into the heart of things and can communicate his own understanding to the soul of things to his readers. Thus, the preface makes it clear that Wordsworth's understanding of his own calling is a very exalted one. The other subheading is the process of poetic creation. Wordsworth also gives a detailed account of the process of poetic creation. His account of poetic creation has to be pieced together from several passages, and each part of it needs to be read in its context. Thus, the memorable and misleading statement that all good poetry is the spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings should not be taken too literally. Nothing could be further from Wordsworth's mind than to equate poetry with a rapid gush of emotion. The statement occurs twice each time in a context which describes intense mental as well as emotional activity. For Wordsworth, the process characteristically begins in a state of calm with remembering of some past emotional experience. Excitement gradually increases until the poet is almost reliving the experience. Yet, with a difference, the present emotion is kindled to, not identical with, that of the past. The difference is that the emotion has now been modified by thought and related to many past thoughts and feelings. The germinal experience has, in fact, been also in the process of being understood and evaluated, and it is by this means that the ensuing poem acquires its worthy purpose. Thought and emotion, conscious and unconscious elements, continued their intimate interaction until the spontaneous overflow begins, that is, until these elements are ready to combine in a poem and begin the work of shaping it. The next subheading is the preface, its richness. The preface is a rich piece of writing. Its themes are manifold and it raises many questions. To quote Margaret Drabble, it is quite impossible to try to give an account of all the questions raised by the preface, for in it Wordsworth covers an enormous stretch of ground, throwing out quite effortlessly the most acute observations on the relationship of poetry and science, on the use of meter, on the place of pleasure in art, on Aristotle, a taste and its cultivation, and on the history of poetry. It raises, in fact, almost every knotty aesthetic problem one can think of, and deals with it with an amazing confidence and energy. It cannot be read too often. Every time it seems to contain something new and unexpected. It marks the beginning of a new age. The next subheading is Some Faults. There is no doubt that the preface has its faults. Coleridge criticized it for the needless obscurity of its latter half and the extreme elaboration and constrainedness of its diction. As Gerard tells us, the preface is a propaganda pamphlet and as such suffers from the sin of exaggeration and overemphasis. Wordsworth frequently goes to extremes. Derek Roper rightly points out that, considered as the introduction to a collection of poems, the preface is not a tactful piece of writing. 40 pages of none too easy prose deterred readers at the outset. Those who preserved ran some risk of being alienated either by the extreme form in which Wordsworth states some of its doctrines, or by his failure of tone, which is sometimes pedantic, sometimes arrogant, and sometimes absurdly defensive. Wordsworth makes bold claims for his poems, such as "not all of them will bear," declares that to appreciate them, drastic revaluations of earlier poetry will be necessary, and cautions the readers interminably as to how they must and must not be read. Despite this care, the account he gives of the poems is misleading, since they are much more diverse than the preface suggests. Coleridge was right in concluding that it was this preface which provoked the hostility of critics from 1802 onwards. The next subheading is its value and significance. Despite this weakness, the preface is probably the most important single document in the history of English criticism. It helped substantially to bring about the reforms Wordsworth most wanted. It gave valuable new insights into the nature, scope, and function of poetry, and into the creative process. Above all, it set new standards for the discussion of such matters by its intense seriousness and by its grasp of inward experience. By comparison with Wordsworth's preface, all previous writings on poetry seem superficial. It is the first critical account of the process of poetic creation. It is the first comprehensive attempt to build up a theory of poetry. The preface is an unofficial manifesto of the English Romantic movement. It explained the aims and objectives of Romanticism and thus gave to the Romantic movement a definite direction and program. As Smith and Parks point out, it raised a wall between the 18th and 19th centuries. It dated a new era. It served to make intelligible forever the dividing line between the two regions in criticism that might otherwise have seemed to flow into one another. We do not often have many such dividing walls. The preface is a great irritant to thought. It poses numerous questions and provokes discussion. The other subheading is, and point C is, Synopsis of Wordsworth's Preface, 1802. The first point is, the first volume of Lyrical Ballads was published without any preface. It had only a brief advertisement. Why did Wordsworth write the preface? His purpose. It was a new kind of poetry, both in theme and language. So his friends advised him to add a preface to the second edition of the poems and explain in it his aims and objectives as well as his theory of poetry. His preface is in the nature of a defense of his theory that poetry must be written in a selection of the real language of men when in a state of emotional excitement. Point 3. His poems were a revolt against the artificial poetic diction popular in the age. Hence, he did not hope for their immediate acceptance, and his friends advised him to add a preface to the second edition to explain his point of view and thus win recognition for his poems. Point 4. He was unwilling to add a preface for a number of reasons. A. It is foolish on the part of a poet to hope that he would win the appreciation of the people through reasoning. B. He should better trust to the good sense of his readers. C. If there is real worth in his poems, appreciations would come by itself. And D. An adequate defense of a new kind of poetry cannot be put forward within the limited compass of a preface. Point 5. However, he decided to add the preface, for he did not like to thrust his poems on the readers abruptly, without any adequate introduction. Point 6. His preface is in the nature of an introduction, rather than systematic defense of his theory of poetry. Then point 7. His purpose in the preface is to warn his readers that poems in the collection are of a new kind, radically different from the conventional poetry to which they are used. They should not expect conventional pleasure from his poems. In this way, they would be saved from disappointment. Then humble and rustic life, reasons for his preference. Point 8. The poet then explains his chief aim in the composition of his poems. His aim has been to choose incidents and situations from common life and to relate them in a selection of language really used by men, and at the same time to throw over them a coloring of imagination whereby ordering things would be presented to the mind in an unusual aspect. Point 9. He has chosen the various aspects of humble and rustic life for a number of reasons. These reasons are, in humble and rustic life, feelings are freely and frankly expressed. B. In rustic life, feelings are more simple and so are expressed more accurately and forcefully. C. The manners of the rustics are not sophisticated. They are simple and so more conducive to an understanding of human nature. And D. In rustic life, human passions are connected with the grand and noble objects of nature, and so they are more noble and permanent. Then the other subheading, choice of rustic language regions. And this is point 10. He has also used the language of humble and rustic life after purifying it of all that is coarse and disgusting in it. He has used the language of rustics because such men hourly communicate with the best objects of nature from which the best part of language is derived, and because from their low rank in society, and also because they are less under the influence of social vanity, they convey their feelings and emotions in a simple and unelaborated language. Such a language is far more philosophical, that is conducive to understanding, than the arbitrary and capricious language used by the poets of the day. Then a stress on emotion, point 11. Every poem in the collection differs from contemporary poetry, in as much as there is nothing mean and trivial about it. Every one of his poems has a worthy purpose, that of enlightening the readers and purifying their emotions. Point 12. They are the spontaneous overflow of passion, but passion has been tempered and modified by thought. The really important and worthwhile alone has been expressed. Point 13. In his poems, feelings are more important than action and situation. Emphasis has been laid on feeling and emotion, and in this way he has tried to correct the contemporary carving for unusual in situation and incident. He has thus tried to enlarge the sensibility of his readers and to wean them away from cheap sensational literature. Then views on poetic diction, point 14. The theme of his poems is different and equally different in his language. He has avoided the various hackneyed devices of poetic diction used by contemporary poets. Then 15th point, he has selected natural themes and he has used a natural language. He has looked steadily at his subject, and so his tendering of it is true to nature. He has also varied his language according to the needs of character and sentiment. His use of language is more sensible and correct. Point 16. Wordsworth concludes that there neither is nor can there ever be any essential difference between the language of prose and verse. The only difference is that the poets use meter, otherwise prose and poetry are closely akin in their nature, appeal and function. Point 17. According to Wordsworth, meter is not essential to poetry, but it is an additional source of pleasure, so its use is desirable. Then point 18. A poet may speak either through his characters or in his own person. In either case, the use of artificial poetic devices is not useless, but actually harmful. When the poet speaks through his characters, the language used must be appropriate to character and situation. And ornate diction would shock and jar the sensible reader. It would be entirely out of place. Then point 19. A simpler diction should be used for the less elevated emotions. This would impart variety to the style and heighten by contrast the harm of the nobler diction used for the more elevated emotions. Point 20. Passion is the primary thing. If the feeling are noble, the expression becomes elevated by itself. Point 21. Wordsworth's purpose in writing the preface was to bring about a revolution in poetic taste. It would also result in a better appreciation of earlier English poets. Then the poet, his qualification. Point number 22. According to Wordsworth, a poet is essentially a man speaking to men. He thus emphasizes the social function of poetry. The poet writes not of his pleasure alone, but for the pleasure of his readers. To give pleasure is the primary function of poetry. Point number 23. A poet differs from an ordinary individual not in nature, but in degree. He is a man who has greater and more lively sensibility, greater power of imagination, greater knowledge of human nature, a more comprehensive soul, so that he can sympathize and feel for others, greater zest for life, and greater powers of communication. Then point number 24. The poet communicates not only personally felt emotions, but also emotions which he has not directly experienced. Hence, his language is often likely to be mechanical. He should try to achieve identification with his characters to make his language more lively and forceful. Then the other subheading, poetic pleasure, poetic truth. This is point number 25th. The purpose of poetry is to give pleasure, and with this end in view, the poet should use a language purified of all that is disgusting and painful. Point number 26. Wordsworth gives his conception of poetic pleasure. Poetic pleasure is not a mere idle amusement, it is much higher and nobler. Point 27. Poetic truth is much higher than the truth of philosophy or history. Poetry is the most philosophical of all writing. Point number 28. Philosophy deals with abstract truths and history with particular illustrations of that truth. Poetry both gives us universal truths and illustrates them through particular examples. Point number 29. Poetry aims at truth to nature, and this truth to nature is modified by only one consideration, that is of giving pleasure. Point number 30. Poetry gives pleasure because A. It imitates nature well, and a thing well imitated causes pleasure. B. It increases our knowledge and understanding of primary nature of man. C. It arouses our sympathy, and sympathy with others brings inner satisfaction. And D. It makes us perceive the essential identity of man and nature. Point number 31. Poetry, according to Wordsworth, is superior to science. The truths of science are particular and individual, while poetic truth is universal and general and can be shared by all. Point number 32. The scientist studies through the intellect, and the knowledge he acquires is superficial. The poet goes down to the soul of things. The truths which he realizes are colored by his imagination and emotion, and hence Wordsworth calls poetry the breath and final spirit of all knowledge. Point number 33. The appeal of the scientist is exclusively to the intellect. That of the poet is to the heart and soul of his readers. Point number 34. Poetic truth is complementary to scientific truth. It endows the achievement of science with emotion and feeling. Point number 35. The use of unnatural ornaments and other stylistic devices implies that the poet has a low opinion of his own calling. That is why he seeks to win admiration by artificial means. Then views on meter. Point number 36. Wordsworth justifies the use of meter and condemns once again the use of poetic diction. Meter is something regular and uniform, while poetic diction is arbitrary and capricious. The rules of meter are fixed. Poetic diction has no such rules. The use of meter is traditional. Point number 37. The poet himself has used meter for a number of reasons. A. Meter is an additional source of pleasure. B. In using meter, he has simply followed tradition. C. Meter can give pleasure even without the use of poetic diction, even when the language is simple and naked. D. Meter has restraining and tempering effect on the flow of emotion and passion. Then point E. It tempers and softens the painful and pathetic. The use of meter has a distancing effect, and in this way an element of pleasure is intermingled with the painful. Point F. It imparts passion to the words and so increases emotional intensity. And G. The use of meter provides the element of contrast, and the perception of similarity is dissimilarity always gives pleasure. Point number 38. Meter gives pleasure as it softens and tempers the painful emotions and imparts grace and dignity to the lighter emotions. Point number 39. Meter gives us an idea of the skill with which the poet has overcome difficulties, and this is a source of pleasure. The next subheading is the poetic process, and this is point number 40. There are four stages through which poetic composition takes place. First, observation. Second, recollection. C, contemplation. D, imaginative excitement of the emotions which were experienced earlier. Such is the process of creation, and it gives joy to the poet. The poet wants to communicate his own joy to the readers, and meter helps him in this communication. Then conclusion, and point number 41. The poet may be criticized for his choice of simple themes and for the simple language that he has used, but he is not going to make any alterations to please the critics, for he is convinced that what he has done is right. Then point number 42. Wordsworth then proves, through suitable illustrations, that the real thing in poetry is feeling and not the language. Worthy sentiment ennobles the language. Then point number 43. Wordsworth appeals to his readers to judge him on the basis of their own feelings and not to be carried away by the views of critics. Then point number 44. His poetry is entirely different from conventional poetry, but if it pleases the people, it would result in the production of a purer poetry capable of giving a permanent and higher pleasure. It is in this hope that he has written. Then the next subheading and point D. Synopsis of the essay supplementary to the preface. 1815. In the opinion of the component critics like Gerard, the essay supplementary which Wordsworth added to the preface to the 1815 edition of the Lyrical Ballads is worthy companion to the preface. So we give here a brief synopsis of the essay supplementary also. The first. Goods critics, their paucity. The first point is, competent and reliable critics of poetry are rare. There are various reasons for it. A. Care and worries of life drive out the taste of poetry. B. The business of earning money and pursuit of worldly power and pelf leaves no time for poetry. C. Poetry is read merely as an escape from the hard realities of life. D. Serious students of poetry are few, but competent critics can come only out of these few serious lovers of poetry. The young are immature, and so they cannot be trustworthy critics. The mature read poetry only occasionally and often at long intervals of time, so their judgment doesn't mature as far as poetry is concerned. Then point F. An artificial poetic tradition and personal and literary prejudices also come in the way of sound judgment, and real excellence is not appreciated. Then point G. Poetry and religion are akin in their natures in many respects, so many serious-minded people search in poetry for moral and religious truths. In case such truths are not there, they are prejudiced against the poet. Then point H. Poetry and religion may be alike in certain respects, but they are sharply distinguished in other respects. Failure to realize this difference results in much misunderstanding. And point I. Passion and imagination are the key notes of poetry, but carried away by their moral and religious predilections and devout remain blind to these excellences. The next subheading, an ideal critic, his qualities. And the point 2. A really competent critic of poetry must have a number of qualities. A. He must be both poetical and philosophical. B. His affections must be free and kindly. C. His understanding must be clear and his judgment dispassionate. Then point D. His vision must not be clouded by his prejudices, literary, personal, or religious. Point E. His sensibility must have been trained by a continuous study of poetry. And F. He must be a mature age. Then point 3. Even when a critic has all the above qualities, he may not be always correct and just in his judgment. Indeed, even the class of such critics includes both the worst and the best. Point 4. That competent and reliable critics are extremely rare is brought out by a brief survey of the history of English poetry during the last two centuries. The survey shows that inferior poets have received immediate recognition, while works of great merit have been generally ignored and neglected. Point 5. This rapid survey also shows that every original poet must create the taste by which he is to be enjoyed and appreciated. Then, poetic taste, ways of creating it. Point 6. The creation of such a taste is a difficult task. The poet must overcome the prejudice, immaturity, and apathy of his readers. He must break the bonds of custom and tradition. 7. He must humanize his readers. He must make them realize the worth of people in humble walks of life. He must shatter their pride and make them humble. He must purify their souls and uplift and exalt them. Point 8. Wordsworth tells us what he means by taste. Taste is an active and cooperative effort of the intellect, and this alone can lead to real appreciation and enjoyment. Point 9. Taste is an energy, a power of intellect, which makes the readers cooperate with the poet to soar high with him and thus to enjoy and appreciate. Point 10. A great poet himself has passion, that is, power or energy to exert both physically and mentally, and he must impart this very passion or energy to his readers. This is the creation of taste and it results in increased knowledge. Then point 11. Pathos is a very complex and intricate emotion. Its varieties are infinite. It is communicated through language. A great poet can shape the language to suit his purposes, but he must also teach his readers to appreciate what is new and original in the language which he has used. Then conclusion. The 12th point. Wordsworth doesn't hope for immediate recognition and popularity. Neither does he care for it, for he knows that only the worthless are easily popular. Point 13. But this doesn't mean that he has no respect for the people. He differentiates the people from the reading public. The reading public comprises a select group, and Wordsworth does not care for the prejudiced judgment of this group. Then point 14. The people, on the other hand, represent the embodied spirit of knowledge, and the poet has full faith in their judgment. He offers his poems to them. Then the next subheading and point E. Wordsworth's conception of poetry, the process of creation poetry as emotions recollected in tranquility, poetry as a spontaneous overflow of powerful feelings. The first subheading, extract from the preface. Critics and poets in all ages and countries have tried to explain their own theory and practice of poetry. Wordsworth, too, expounded his views on poetry, its nature and functions, and the qualifications of a true poet in his preface to the 1802 edition of the Lyrical Ballads, and later developed his theory in preface to 1815 edition and a supplementary essay. Few compositions of equal length contain so much of vigorous criticism and sound reflection on poetry, its nature and function, as the 1802 preface. Then passion, its spontaneous overflow. As regards the nature of poetry, the poet clearly states that poetry is the spontaneous overflow of powerful passion. In other words, poetry proceeds from the internal feelings of the poet. It is a matter of feeling, mood, and temperament. When the mood is on him, it flows naturally and without labor. Poetry, true poetry, cannot be written without this proper mood and temperament. We cannot ask a poet to write at our sweet will. Poetry cannot be produced to order. It must flow out voluntarily and willingly from the soul of the poet. As has been well said, the clear springs of poetry must flow freely and spontaneously. It cannot be made to flow through artificially laid pipes. Secondly, poetry is a matter of feelings, powerful feelings at that. It is generated in the heart and not in the mind. It is never an intellectual process. Poetry is born not in the mind but in the heart of overflowing with feelings. Poets are gifted with greater organic sensibility than ordinary individuals. They have greater capacity to receive sense impressions. Beauties of nature, which may leave ordinary mortals cold and untouched, excite in the poet powerful emotions, and he feels an urge to express those emotions and thus convey his joy to others. Wordsworth himself was such an individual. His heart leaped up with joy on beholding a rainbow in the sky or daffodils dancing in the breeze, and he expressed his powerful, overflowing feelings spontaneously of his own accord in his immortal poems. The next heading is the role of reflection, four stages of the process of creation. But according to Wordsworth, good poetry is never an immediate expression of such powerful emotions. A good poet must meditate and ponder over them long and deeply. In other words, poetry has its origin in emotions recollected in tranquility. There are at least four stages through which an experience has to pass before successful composition becomes possible. First of all, there is the observation of perception of some object, character, or incident which sets up powerful emotions in the mind of the poet. Secondly, there is recollection or contemplation of that emotion in tranquility. At this second stage, memory plays a very important part. An interval of time, it may be quite long, say 10 hours, must elapse, during which the first experience sinks deep into the poet's consciousness and becomes a part and parcel of his being. As during the interval, the mind contemplates in tranquility the impression received by it, it is purged of the non-essential elements, accidents, or superfluities, is qualified by various pleasures. This filtering or selective process is very slow. Time and solitude are essential. In this way, the poet's emotion is universalized. Thirdly, the interrogation of memory by the poet sets up or receives the emotion in the mind itself. It is very much like the first emotion, but is purged of all superfluities and constitutes a state of enjoyment. This doesn't mean that the creative process is a tranquil one, tranquil. The poet expressly points out that in the process of contemplation, tranquility disappears. When creating, the poet has to passion anew and is terribly exhausted as a consequence. Dorothy's journal proves beyond a shadow of doubt that creation exhausted out poet terribly. But creation, if it be healthy, carries with it joy, or what Wordsworth calls an overbalance of pleasure. On the whole, the mood of imaginative creation is enjoyment. How does it all happen? How does the selective process take place so as to leave behind a state of enjoyment? Wordsworth provides no answer to the riddle and simply ascribes it to nature. In other words, the creative process is natural. The ability to create comes from nature and not from premeditated art. The fourth and last stage is the stage of composition. The poet must convey that overbalance of pleasure, his own state of enjoyment, to others. He differs from ordinary individuals not merely in his greater sensibility, but also in his capacity to communicate his experience to others, and to communicate them in such a way as to give pleasure. Meter is justified, for it is pleasure superadded. Verse will be read 100 times where prose is read only once. H. Reed has admirably summed up Wordsworth's theory of poetry and poetic composition in the following words: "Good poetry is never an immediate reaction to the provoking cause, that our sensations must be allowed time to sink back into the common fund of our experience, there to find their level and due proportion. That level is found for them by the mind in the act of contemplation, and then in the process of contemplation the sensations revive, and out of the union of contemplating mind and receiving sensibility rises that unique mood of expression which we call poetry." The next subheading is Wordsworth's practice. Wordsworth himself closely followed his theory in his practice. He rarely made a present joy the matter of a song, still less a present sorrow. He did not poetize an experience immediately. There are hardly 10 poems in the bulk of his output, which he described as extempore. His characteristic mode of composition was to place a wide interval between the experience and its poetic delineation. He had a powerful memory, and sometimes he would fetch out an impression from hiding places 10 years deep. All his best poems, The Daffodils, Tintern Abbey, Pelée Castle, Solitary Reaper, resulted from emotions recollected in tranquility. It is a recollection in tranquility which enables the poet to see into the heart of things and communicate the very soul or essence of an experience to his readers. It is through such contemplation that the poet is able to impart to everyday objects a visionary gleam, a glory, a light that never was on land and sea. As such recollection is best done in solitude, the poet loved lonely places, liked to wander all alone, oblivious of time and place, lost in reverie, R-E-V-E-R-I-E. And came to be known by the simple rustics of Cumberland as the solitary who was rather crazed. Then the next subheading is Poetry, its function. As regards the true function of poetry, Wordsworth tells us that its function is to give pleasure. Even when the subject is painful in itself, it must be so treated that it would result in an overplush of pleasure. The poet is himself in a state of enjoyment, and it is his duty to communicate his own enjoyment to his readers. But pleasure is not the only, not even the chief aim of the poetry. Its aims are much more exalted and noble. Poetry is not a mere entertainment, a diversion for a patron's ideal hours, like seri or rope dancing. It is, he tells us, the breath and finer spirit of all knowledge, the impassioned expression that is in the countenance of all science. To be incapable of a feeling for poetry in the true sense of the word is to be without love of human nature and reverence for God. Its mission is to arouse the sensual from their sleep of death and win the vacant and the vain to noble rapture. Thus, poetry, to be worth the name, must serve the purposes of life and morality. Poetry divorced from morality is valueless. I repeat the line, poetry divorced from morality is valueless. Through his own poetry, he hoped to console the afflicted, to add sunshine to daylight by making the happy happier, to lead the young and the gracious of every age to see, to think, and to feel, and therefore to become more actively and securely virtuous. The next subheading is Poetry, its themes. What are the proper subjects of poetry? Of course, any subject between heaven and earth can be poetically treated, but Wordsworth preferred incidents, situations, and characters taken from low and rustic life. He made the dalesmen and women of Cumberland, their lives and characters, and everyday objects of nature the subjects of his poetry, because in that condition of life the elementary passions and emotions find a clearer and freer expression, for they are not repressed or inhibited by convention, as is the case with more sophisticated people. They can be observed more clearly and expressed more accurately. Moreover, such elementary passions in rural conditions are associated with the beautiful and permanent forms of nature. The poet must deal with such simple subjects, but so as to throw over them a certain coloring of imagination, whereby ordinary things should be presented to the mind in an unusual way. The mental process by which this aim is achieved has already been discussed above. It should also be noted that for Wordsworth, it is the feeling and emotion that is important and not action and situation. Feeling developed in a poem gives importance to the action and situation, and not the action and situation to the feeling. The poet's reoccupation with feeling would become obvious even from a cursory perusal of his poetry. The next subheading is its diction and language. Wordsworth's theory of poetic diction, it may also be added, was a direct outcome of his democratic preference for simple rustic life and characters. When the theme was simple, the language must be simple too. It must be a selection of the language really spoken by such men, otherwise it would not be in character. It is therefore critical of artificial poetic diction of 18th century poet. Then the other subheading and point F is themes of poetry, humble and rustic life, incidents and situations from common life. Preference for humble life and regions. The poetry of pseudo-classical school was very artificial and unnatural. It was extremely limited in its themes. It was confined exclusively to the city of London, and in that city to the artificial and unnatural life of the fashionable lords and ladies. It did not care for beauties of nature or for the humble humanity, farmers, shepherds, woodcutters, etc., which lives its simple life in the lap of nature. Wordsworth reacted sharply and sought to increase the range of English poetry by taking his themes from humble and rustic life. Himself living in the lap of nature, he was well familiar with the life of these humble people, and he was rendered it in his poetry realistically and accurately. There are various reasons why Wordsworth preferred incidents and situations from the humble life. As the themes of his poetry, for one thing, In this way, he could enlarge the scope and range of poetry and make a whiff of fresh air to blow through the suffocating atmosphere of contemporary poetry. Secondly, he knew this life intimately, was in sympathy with it, and so could render it accurately and feelingly. Thirdly, he believed that a poet is essentially a man speaking to man. Since he is a man and he has to appeal to the heart and mind of man, he must study human nature and try to understand the primary law of our nature. Now, these primary instincts and impulses which govern human conduct can best be understood by studying the simplest and most elementary forms of life. He chose rustic and humble life because the village farmers, leech gatherers, even idiots represent human life reduced to its simplest. It is for this reason also that he glorified the child and stressed the value of childhood memories and experiences. In such simple forms of life, behavior is instinctive and manners are natural and uninhibited. Feelings and passions are expressed without any reserve, and human conduct is guided and controlled not by artificial social codes as in more sophisticated city societies, but by instincts and impulses. In humble and rustic conditions of life, man is more natural, and so a proper subject of study for a poet who must write on man, on nature, and on human life. He did not think city life to be a proper subject of poetry because there the fundamental passions of human heart are not expressed freely and forcefully, but are inhibited by social codes and considerations of public opinion. Fourthly, in rustic and humble life, the fundamental passion of the human heart can be easily studied. From a study and understanding of these elementary feelings, the poet can proceed to study the primary laws of our nature. In other words, though a process of contemplation and reflection, the poet can derive certain universal principles of human conduct, which are not true only of individuals or of particular places, but are universal and general in their application. Feelings and passions of humble humanity are not peculiar to them, but are common to all mankind. They will last as long as human nature lasts, and are not subject to fluctuations from age to age and society to society. They are universal, they are permanent, as contrasted with those of socially inhibited societal man. Universal significance of human experience and human emotion can be studied only through the life reduced to its simplest and, we may add, most unfortunate levels. Then fifthly, we preferred rustic and humble life because in that condition the passions of man are incorporated with the beautiful and permanent forms of nature. They live in the midst of grandeur and beauty of nature, and as Plato much earlier has taught us, they must absorb some of that beauty and grandeur. In this connection, it will not be out of place to refer to romantic glorification of primitive and the cult of the noble savage. In one of his own Lucy poems, Wordsworth refers to the education of nature and the vital feelings which nature confers on those who live in her. Their emotions are noble and permanent because their souls have been molded by the beautiful and permanent forms of nature. Then the next subheading is Criticism of Wordsworth's Views. Wordsworth has been criticized for thus limiting the scope of poetry to humble and rustic life. It has been said that upper class life is as suitable for poetic treatment as humble life. In this way, Wordsworth exulted from poetic treatment of a wide range of complex human emotions which are experienced only in more sophisticated societies. However, Wordsworth's views are to be judged in the historical context as resulting from his desire to extend the domain of poetry, conquer new territories for it, and thus to correct the contemporary predilection for upper-class life to the exclusion of humble and rustic life. Then point G and the next subheading, the language of poetry, Wordsworth's theory of poetic diction, its limitations and contradictions, Coleridge's criticism. Wordsworth's purpose, simplicity in theme and treatment. It has been generally supposed that Wordsworth's theory of poetic language is merely a reaction against and a criticism of pseudo-classical theory of poetic diction, but such a view is true only partially. His first impulse was less a revolt against pseudo-classical diction than a desire to find a suitable language for the new territory of human life which he was conquering for poetic treatment. It is the statement of O. Elton. His aim was to deal in his poetry with rustic and humble life, and it is quite natural that he should also advocate simplicity of language to suit the simplicity of theme. Moreover, he believed that the poet is essentially a man speaking to man, and so he must make use of such a language as is used by men. The pseudo-classics advocated that the language of poetry is different from the language of prose, while Wordsworth believes that there is no essential difference between the language of prose and metrical composition. The poet has to communicate, and he can communicate best in the language which is really used by men. He condemns the artificial language, such as that of the school of Pope, as masquerade of tricks, quaintnesses, hieroglyphics, and enigmas. The next subheading is real language of men, selection. As he tells us in preface, his purpose was to choose incidents and situations from the common life, and therefore, quite naturally, he also intended to use a selection of language really used by man. He was to deal with humble and rustic life, and so it was in the fitness of things that he should also use the language of the rustics, farmers, shepherds, who were to be subjects of his poetry. The language of these men was to be used, but it was to be purified of all that is painful or disgusting in that language. It was to be purified of all that is vulgar and coarse in such a language. He was to use such a selection of language of real man because the aim of a poet is to give pleasure, and such language without selection will cause disgust. Only a judicious selection of such a language can give pleasure. The next subheading is simple diction, its advantages. The use of such a simple language has a number of advantages. The rustic language, in its simplicity, is highly emotional and passionate. This is more so the case when these humble people are in a state of emotional excitement. It is charged with the emotions of the human heart, which are expressed without any reservations and inhibitions resulting from social vanity. Such a language is the natural language of the passions. It comes from the heart and thus goes direct to the heart. In other words, through the use of such a language, essential truths about human life and nature can be more easily and clearly communicated. It is a more philosophical language, in as much as its use can result in a better and clearer understanding of the basic truths. The rustics are in communication every hour with the beauty and grandeur of nature. The best part of their language is derived from such communication, so it is noble and poetic. It is capable of giving the highest poetic pleasure. The next subheading is Arguments Against Poetic Diction. In the opinion of Wordsworth, the language of poetry must not be separated from the language of men in real life. Figures, metaphors, and similes and other such decorations must not be used unnecessarily, as was the case with the artificial 18th century poetic diction. In a state of emotional excitement, men naturally use a metaphorical language to express themselves forcefully. The earliest poets used only such metaphors and images as result naturally from powerful emotions. Later on, poets used a figurative language which was not the result of genuine passion. They merely imitated the manner of the earlier poets, and thus arose the artificial language and diction of the pseudo-classics. A stereotyped and mechanical phraseology thus became current. The poet must avoid the use of such artificial diction both when he speaks in his own person and when he speaks through his characters. He must not use it when he speaks in his own person, for it is not the real language of man, and he is a man speaking to man. He must not use it when he speaks through his characters, for in that case he must vary it according to the nature, rank and status, thought and emotions of character who speaks it. The next subheading is Contradictions in Wordsworth's Theory, Coleridge's Criticism of It. Wordsworth's theory of poetic diction is of immense value when considered as a corrective to the artificial, inane and unnatural phraseology current at the time. But considered in itself, it is full of number of contradictions and suffers from a number of imitations. For one thing, Wordsworth doesn't state what he means by language. Language is a matter of words as well as of arrangement of those words. It is a matter of vocabulary as well as of syntax. It is also a matter of the use of imaginary, frequency of its use and its nature. Wordsworth doesn't clarify what he exactly means by language. Coleridge was the first critic to pounce upon Wordsworth's theory of language and to expose its many weaknesses. He pointed out, first, that a language so selected and purified as Wordsworth recommends would differ in no way from the language of any other man of common sense. After such a selection, there would be no difference between the rustic language and the language used by a man in other walks of life. Secondly, Wordsworth permits the use of meter, and this implies a particular order and arrangement of words. If meter is to be used, the order of words in poetry is bound to differ from that of prose. It does so differ in the poetry of Wordsworth himself. Meter mediates the whole atmosphere, and the language of poetry is bound to differ from that of prose. So Coleridge concludes that there is and there ought to be an essential difference between the language of prose and metrical composition. Thirdly, the use of meter is as artificial as the use of poetic diction, and if one is allowed, it is absurd to forbid the use of the other. Both are equally good source of poetic pleasure. Fourthly, Coleridge objected to the use of the word real. He writes, "Every man's language varies according to the extent of his knowledge, the activity of his faculties, and the depth or quickness of his feelings. Every man's language has, first, its individualities, secondly, the common properties of the class to which he belongs, and thirdly, words and phrases of universal use. For real, therefore, we must substitute ordinary or lingua communis, LINGUACOMMUNIS. Fifthly, Coleridge pointed out that it is not correct that the best part of our language are derived from nature. Language is later molded. The best words are abstracts, nouns, and concepts. These are derived from the reflective act of the mind, and reflection grows as man advances from the so-called primitive state. As man has advanced in thought, he has acquired new ideas and concepts which cannot be expressed through the use of rustic language, which is primitive and undeveloped. If the poet wants to use rustic language, he must also think like the rustics. The language of rustics is curiously inexpressive. It would be putting the clock back. Instead of progression, it would be retrogression. Then the another subheading is Eliot's criticism. In more recent times, T.S. Eliot has exposed the many contradictions inherent in Wordsworth's theory of language. In the advertisement to the first edition of the Lyrical Ballads, he said that he had used the language of conversation in the middle and lower classes of life. T.S. Eliot asks, did Wordsworth examine the language of conversation in the higher classes? If a character belongs to the upper class, the use of language of that class is as proper as the use of rustic language when the speaker is rustic. From 1800 onwards, he speaks of a selection of the real language of man in a state of vivid sensation, and he says, I propose to myself to imitate, and as far as possible, to adopt the very language of man. Selection has come in, and yet it is to be very language of man. In 1802 and 1805, he says that he would bring his language near to the language of man. Here he speaks of approximation only and thus contradicts his earlier statement. Thus, there are contradictions and inconsistencies in Wordsworth's successive pronouncements on the subject, and it often becomes difficult to mark out what he exactly means by the real language of man, and who is to make the selection which will fit the real language of man for poetic purposes. Such are the weaknesses of Wordsworth's theory. He must also be admitted that the poet did not adhere to his theory in his own practice. Inverted and poetic constructions are frequent in his poetry, and often even his vocabulary is not drawn from rustic life. He doesn't always use the language of real man, that is, the rustics of Cumberland. Then conclusion. The real significance of Wordsworth's theory. Wordsworth's theory of language has strong weaknesses, but its significance is also far-reaching. O. Eliton concludes his discussion of the subject with the following admirable words. The conclusion, then, is that Wordsworth led by his dislike of glossy and unfeeling diction, but still more by the wish to find a poetic medium for the life and speech of the simple, was led to proclaim that speech as the medium desired, that he guarded his chosen medium not indeed from his own misapplication of it, but against the charge that it need be vulgar or trifling, that he also proved its nobility in practice, that he did not clearly say what he meant by language, or see the full effect upon the diction by the employment of meter, that he did not rule out other styles, either his own or those of the other man, which are equally poetical, though he did not touch on their theoretic basis, and that is in many of his actual triumphs, won within that sphere of diction which he does vindicate. He employs a stratum of words which in prose would not strike us as over-poetical.